This is the last of this series of five talks to form a commentary on our book, Self-Unfoldment. And looking through the closing chapters, several things came to mind which I think should be added to the text as it appears, and perhaps someday we will be able to include it in future editions. But now, this is a preview. We have discussed at considerable length the problem of realization, and I hope that from both the discussion and the book, you have a fair idea of what we mean by this term. But I think we can carry it a little further to represent a clear state of internal honesty. Actually, all spiritual growth must begin with honesty. And while the average person certainly is not out to filch his neighbor's goods, there are forms of honesty which we do not understand. And one of the most complicated is internal honesty. There are so many situations which tempt us away from simple, direct, honest evaluation. And I know of no work dealing with this subject more appropriate than one of the discourses of Buddha. The original discourse is rather complicated and involves a number of strange and difficult terms, and also embraces a much larger area than we can deal with at the moment. So I want to paraphrase or simplify a few of the basic thoughts in order that perhaps they will help us to understand the subject of internal honesty. The discourse is arranged in a curious series of repetitive phrases which arise in a good many of Buddha's teachings. And these, while they may seem unnecessary, have a tendency to fix the thoughts more clearly in our minds. So we can take one or two of the points and dress them a little in modern term, but try to keep something of this reiterative phrasing, which I think has helpfulness in it. He says, in substance, for example, when desire arises in the mind, a man may say, "This I desire. This is desirable. If I have this, I shall be happy. If I do not have this, I shall be unhappy. Therefore, I must quest desperately after the object of my desire." Then Buddha says, "But the wise man, when desire arises in the mind, shall say, desire has arisen in the mind." This is all the fact we have to deal with. This is the substance. All the rest is lies. Now, if we can come down to this very simple core realization, we will begin to have a greater insight into realization as honesty. Buddha then goes on to take a wide variety of situations. He says, a man may say to himself, "This I hate. Therefore, this is hateful. This I must oppose. I must dislike. I must indicate in every way possible that I abhor this thing. I must turn against it all the antagonism I possess." But the wise man, when hate arises in the mind, shall say, "Hate has arisen in my mind. That is the entire substance of this thing. Now, if we can get this close to fact, it will be a very helpful and wonderful thing. Some people are a little afraid of fact. They regard it as cold, rather calculating, not very inspiring. But this concept as given by Buddha is not cold, nor is it condemning, nor is it self-criticizing, nor does it lack gentleness or insight. It is simply the gentle fact. If we can apply this type of gentle fact to the various situations that come along and which we have to face, we shall discover the basic point that he is trying to clear for us. Namely, that we live in two conditions. One is the basic condition of desiring. Desire arises within us spontaneously. The second condition is the perpetual quest of that which is desired. Consequently, what we call activity is almost exclusively the fulfillment of desire in some way. It may take complicated, highly intellectualized forms, but we are pressed by certain attitudes which arise in us, and in due course we become enslaved by these attitudes. We become their servants. We find our entire life spent in trying to satisfy this stream of desire that is constantly flowing from its fountains within ourselves. We therefore seldom pause to say to ourselves, do I need this which I desire? Is my desire right? Is it necessary? Is it good? Is it valid? Rather than this, we simply go on desiring and gradually lose the habit of examining the desire in term of fact. Now, if we were able to control this desire pattern well enough, we would probably ultimately reach that condition in which we could censor desire before it moves into action. If we could do this, we would live more moderately and would find that our means and our conditions would become closer to our needs than we had previously imagined. So the only place where we can really cut off illusion is at its root. And that root is always in ourselves. Realization helps us to understand the nature of this root and gives us the strength and discrimination to analyze ourselves honestly. Now, honesty goes beyond even these physical desirings. It goes into thought, into beliefs, into convictions, into policies by which we live, into reactions to conditions that arise around us. But always, we must ask ourselves the simple question, what is the fact? And the fact, separated from all its involvements, is not only simpler than it might first appear, but at this stage in its development, the desire can be changed and corrected rather easily. There is an old story that the Grand Canyon of the Colorado, one of the world's most magnificent scenic panoramas, was originally a tiny little trench in the ground, probably an inch deep. At that time, any man could have changed its course with his foot. Now, there is no force known to man that can change its course. Or if such a thing be achieved by engineering, it would represent a vast expenditure of time and energy. It is the same with our own patterns, with the flow of our own impulses. If we can catch these at their roots, if we can work at them from their beginning, we will simplify and order life tremendously. Realization exists to help us to understand all these things. First of all, it gives us composure. And composure is necessary to honesty. We may mean to be honest, but if we are disturbed and unsettled within ourselves, uncomfortable, then we have not the same ability to estimate. In the presence of discomfort, our first impulse is to escape into a more comfortable condition. And in obedience to this impulse, we may go further away from fact. Thus, evasion, fulfillment, excuse, resentment, these arise within us, but they tell us nothing that is truly useful, except that they themselves are false. Now, we cannot expect persons to make complete renovations of themselves in a moment. Certainly, Buddha never expected his disciples to achieve this. All that he asks is that the individual becomes aware. And having once established an awareness in himself, he finds it instinctive to begin to use this awareness in an effort to improve his condition. He becomes a little more thoughtful. He begins to practice a preventive therapy, rather than to depend upon some curative agency for a remedy. Realization, as we have said, therefore, must be in an internal quietude. The individual must be able to relax. In order to relax, he must have values, because no individual can trust himself comfortably to the unknown. We have to chart the unknown. And most of all, we have to take out of it its formidable or dreadful appearance. The unknown is dangerous to us only while we approach it without adequate internal enlightenment. So enlightenment is a measure, at least, man's turning the light of consciousness upon the unknown and discovering, probably to his amazement, that the unknown is very pleasant. That the unknown is really the source of all known good, as well as apparently the source of all known difficulty. The unknown is simply the unexperienced, that which we have not yet faced or solved. But it presents no problems different, no difficulties more real than those which also surround us in the known. And also in the unknown lie all our hopes. The hopes of things yet to be done, dreams yet to be fulfilled, the best yet to be accomplished. So out of gradually increasing internal insight, we are able to attain composure. Composure is a kind of treaty that is set up between ourselves and other things. It is a truce. It is an end of hostility. It means that we have accepted a non-belligerent life, a life in which we are neither going to hurt nor be hurt. Rather, we are going to use facts to protect value, and in so doing, to live as nobly and serenely and beautifully as we can. Once some of these convictions begin to take hold, we begin to find internal resources that we did not suspect. We discover that within ourselves lie also all the elements needed for adjustment. It is not that inside we are all problem. Inside we are both problem and solution. If we overwork problem, we will be problem. If we work more industriously at solution, we will find solution. The very same inner life is both our problem and our achievement, so that we do not need to take the attitude that we are weakness, or that we are insufficiency or instability. Another thing that we learn from realization is that at any given moment, each individual is sufficient to his own need. This seems a very difficult thing to believe sometimes, for it is at some given moment that we suddenly feel that we are not sufficient to our own need. The reason we are not sufficient is that we have not called upon sufficiency. We have rather acknowledged insufficiency. We have accepted the negative as inevitable. We have accepted the worst part of ourselves as the strongest part. Therefore, we have very little interior consolation. We are sufficient to our need at any moment. The reason for this is that our needs arise from ourselves. Each individual, according to his own station in life consciousness, creates a situation around him which is the direct result of what he is. It is not the result of what he might be or what he has been. It is the result of what he is. Therefore, the situation is always balanced by the person in that situation. The situation is never larger nor smaller than the person. It consequently follows that as the individual could get himself into a situation by a certain group of attitudes, he possesses also the means of extricating himself from that situation by the proper use of those same attitudes. He does not have to be bigger than he is to be what he is. He merely has to use the faculties and powers with which he is endowed. Now, it is quite obvious that the problems of a highly advanced physicist might be quite different from the problems of an average clerk in a store. Also, the attainments of these two persons may be different. But the physicist, in ratio to his problem, is in exactly the same situation as the clerk in ratio to his problem. The physicist can just solve his problem if he will. The clerk can just solve his problem if he will. Each has been given a kind of allotment, and this allotment is the cause of his difficulty and the solution. He must therefore never feel that he must become more than he can be in order to achieve freedom from conditions as they are. He merely has to use properly the instruments already at his command. It is not lack of instruments, it is lack of use that perpetuates a misfortune. Realization, then, is attainable on almost any conceivable level. We are not even sure that realization is limited to human beings. There are symptoms and indications which might cause us to think that certain members of the animal kingdom also have rudimentary realization. They have certain internal acceptances, which perhaps with them are more instinctive than with us. But these acceptances seem to indicate that these creatures are very close to a source of life or a source of knowledge that is equal to their need and have been wonderfully endowed with the faculty required for the preservation of themselves through normal situations, perhaps not through excessive situation, but certainly they have faculties which can guide them, and our own human needs are supplied by faculties which can guide us with equal effectiveness. Realization is a way of making these values available to the conscious person. It is one thing to have your treasures locked in a house, and it is another thing to bring these treasures into light and to use them and to apply them to their proper ends. In the Bible story, Jesus was not too patient with the man who buried his talent. Rather, it was important that this individual should make use of his abilities, make use of his resources, and not lock them within himself. The realization also prevents us from doing one of the things that can make troubles worse very quickly, and that is a desperate thrashing out against adversity. The individual who under pressure becomes desperate is only increasing his own dilemma. Realization prevents this deep end situation. It causes the person to recognize that the greater his responsibility or the more real his problem, the greater his need for quietude. That it is only in the quietude of personal integration that we can work our way through problems using all of the resources at our hand or available to us. The moment we lose this internal calm, we block out full areas of mental and emotional wisdom. We close ourselves to these principles which alone could bring us relief. So in the quietude of things, in realization, we evaluate our own living. We think it through. We live with ourselves conscious. We try to be as impersonal in the judging of ourselves as we can. We think no longer of our poor, battered selfness. We think, rather, of our own incorrigibilities, those natural delinquencies which produce natural sorrow. And we know that the only answer is to correct and to curb, to integrate and to strengthen. Now, realization as itself has been taught, or as a fact in itself, has been taught in many systems. But I have always personally felt that when you isolate a discipline from the common intercourse of life, you very largely destroy its effectiveness. We know that mystics have retired to forlorn and desolate places, and there have tried to live in communion with themselves. We know also that throughout nearly all of the records that we have of human endeavor, certain spiritual virtues have been given tremendous prominence, and nearly all other aspects of life have been neglected. Perhaps this is one of the reasons why the virtues haven't worked better. It is quite possible that we would be much further along in our religious life if we had not isolated it, if we had not considered it to be either a particular phase of existence or, by contrary attitude, total existence with nothing else left of importance. We have gone overboard one way or another. And when the individual goes overboard, he's in the water. And when he is in the water, to use the parlance of the day, he may very well become moist. In fact, he may drown. So, in our realization, we have to be rather careful that we do not drive it, that we do not go beyond the natural field for which it is intended. To do a good job on the level of realization discipline, we must be certain, therefore, that it is not realization under pressure. Or as one man came to me one day and he said, I have experienced what I call pressureful relaxation. Now, this is what I think some of us have done in connection with religion. We have overdone certain virtues. We have forced things rather than to recognize that in realization, anything which tips it away from its own natural equilibrium destroys it as far as a useful instrument for our purpose. Realization, then, does not come alone from love of God or love of man. These help. These are great and powerful instruments of revelation and of insight. But there is more. Realization arises from a whole group of simple, natural processes, which must also be properly cultivated. The individual who loves God but does not appreciate beauty is deficient in a very marked manner. An individual who cannot enjoy simple things will probably not very soon have the opportunity to enjoy universal consciousness. We have to balance this realization problem. It must be a rich realization. And it must not, under any circumstance, arise from a pressure by which an individual might be caused to say to himself, I cannot endure things as they are. Therefore, I've got to outgrow them or perish. This might be the substance of a dilemma, but still it is not the right attitude. Realization is the condition in which we want to realize more, because what we already realize is so sufficient. Not that we are impoverished and bankrupt at the moment and are searching desperately to find some way of getting a small deposit in our own name. Realization is not running away from the miserable, because if the miserable still remains, we are not ready for realization. It does not mean a hastening from loneliness or isolation of any kind. It does not mean that we are seeking a cure or a remedy or an answer, primarily. Realization is much more than these things, and very different. Realization is more actually the wonderful experience of the thing as it is, needing no more than itself, but only available to us when we have begun to warm up appreciation in many areas of our existence. This is why, for so long, I have advocated that the individual who searches for spiritual value shall have as large an area of conscious experience as possible. The more he can experience without criticism or condemnation, the better he is. This I do not mean to imply that he should not be aware of the faults of his work, but that beyond this awareness of fault should also be an awareness of reason and meaning. The things are as they are because certain processes are in their midmost methods. They are not complete. They are not perfect. Yet in themselves, they are meaningful and worthy of our most thoughtful and generous consideration. I like to think, therefore, that any person who is interested in self-improvement can sit down and enjoy a good book. Not necessarily a philosophical book, but a book which is rich in human experience. A book which has gently and lovingly carried a message from some person who really believed that he had a contribution to make. Good literature is important to good living. Good art is important. The individual who says to himself, yes, that's true, I need these things, but I'm too busy, I'll get around to it someday, has not in himself the hunger for the beautiful. And the lack of this natural appetite is going to affect his spiritual life just as much as it affects his environment. The individual who is not anxious to be busy, who does not feel that work is life, also is closing himself to growth and progress. The individual who overvalues leisure, seeking to escape useful and interesting tasks simply because of the belief that leisure is the sign of superiority, this type of person is in trouble. One of the greatest difficulties in our modern fields of psychology arises from the fact that the individual has mistaken leisure for personal attainment, and he has done nothing with it. Leisure without proper vision, without proper insight, can be a very heavy burden upon the flesh and lead us into many troubles. The individual, therefore, who has no interest in nature, in flowers and plants and birds and beasts, who has no sympathy for the arts and the crafts and the trades, who has no instinct to make something with his own hands, to create, such a person is impoverished in those attitudes which are essential to realization. Realization is from a richness and not from a poverty. And our inner meditations are richest and most beautiful when they are supported by many glorious experiences which we have been permitted to enjoy in the course of years. Thus our realization is a mature, a rich fulfillment of things. Let us say to ourselves, just because it will give us a point to work with, supposing an accident occurred to us. Supposing tomorrow we found ourselves in a terrible accident from which we were able to survive, but with the loss of sight and the loss of motion, that we had nothing left but our internal life and hearing. Would such a condition leave us totally impoverished? It did not leave Helen Keller totally impoverished, although she had motion, but she did have the loss of more than one faculty. She neither saw nor heard. Yet her life became extremely rich because of its inwardness. Now the person in the midstream of life, suddenly deprived of his external resources, would have to build his life out of his own experience. Let us also remember that someday we shall be deprived not only of sight, hearing, touch, smell, and taste, but also of body, by a mysterious circumstance which we call death. As far as this world is concerned, we will rest with the ages. What do we take with us? Those things which we take with us must be the richness of our inner life, and as Buddha says, our experience, and as Socrates said, that which we have learned. These are the things which we take with us. Now, when we enter into meditation or realization, we do almost the same thing. We cut out the world temporarily, maybe for 5 minutes only. But in those 5 minutes, we live more intimately with ourselves than at any other time in our existence. It is therefore important to us that this inner self be rich. Rich not with false notions or opinions or merely intellection, which falls away very quickly, but rich in achieved value, rich in memories, beautiful, true, wise, rich in the knowledge of friendships, rich in achievement, rich in appreciation. rich in the sense of creative self-expression. These things become the basis of a different kind of warmth. This is no longer the warmth of desiring. It is rather the gentle warmth of reflection. It surrounds us with a very warm glow, a very friendliness, a freedom from loneliness or isolation because of the richness in ourselves. This warmth is not dangerous. It is not the fire of hate or jealousy. It is the warmth of understanding, a very different kind of temperature. So realization, meaning that we go in, means that we must find on the inside what we need. And we can only find there what we have put there. And as Socrates pointed out, life is a kind of preparation for something beyond life. So also experience. All of the constructive values which we have generated in our nature are preparations for the release of the full internal. Also remember that release is itself a valid factor in realization, coming under the general heading of the creation of the transcendent being. Release means the ability to express for that which is within to come out, to find adequate and proper channels. Release, therefore, is only adequate when the personality and the body are suitable for this release. The old story about the new wine and the old bottles and vice versa comes to mind. It is also true that the training of the body, the unfoldment of its aptitude, this can be tremendously significant. Suppose we say for a moment that you are a musician. Actually, your music has always been a close interest. And from this music, you have gradually moved into a mystical appreciation of life. How fortunate, then, you are. For now you have hands that are trained, so that they will respond instinctively to the impulses of your thought. You can sit down at a musical instrument, and you can play these melodies which you hear within yourself, which are not of this world. How much more these melodies would be lost if your own skill was not equal to your internal appreciation. Unless you can release, you have to a measure failed in your purpose. Or if you are a vocalist, your trained body reacting to the impulses of your will permit you to express creatively, through song, the inner convictions of your consciousness. A good carpenter has skilled hands. A great surgeon has skilled hands. Persons in every walk of life who achieve gain certain skills. And skill is mental, emotional, or bodily control. Thus, the controlled body becomes the adequate instrument for the expression of disciplined conviction. One without the other is imperfect. And while it is undoubtedly true that the internal takes precedence over the external, for without the internal, there is no justification for the external. It is also even more true that the internal must use the external as the channel or means of its expression and release. and if the body, the mind, and the emotions are not responsive, if the individual has no trained ability with which to express that which is within himself, he is, to a measure, deprived of his greatest usefulness. Now, it's a possibility that these trained abilities are the more unselfish part. For it is perfectly possible for the individual to feel that he has inner knowledge. But the unselfish part is to share, to see that this knowledge serves common need. And unless this instinct is also present, there is something wrong with knowledge. And if the individual, having internal enlightenment, has no desire and no instinct to express this in some way, he is also deficient in many of the more natural human graces. It is not his expression of his enlightenment that will cause trouble. It is, however, the expression of his unenlightenment, perhaps not even so recognized, that may cause a certain amount of difficulty. So in realization, we need the cooperation of the total personality. We need the whole of the person brought together to become the instrument of one purpose. And the richer this personality is, the more ways it can use or distribute or rationalize knowledge. And the skillful person, dominated by a great conviction, is the most useful of all individuals. Skill without conviction is dangerous. But conviction without skill is frustration. Now, many people feel that if the internal adjustments are made, the skill will inevitably follow. This is not quite true. I've known a great many persons interested in various types of development, but I've never learned that any one of them mastered a foreign language without studying it, or mastered music without taking lessons or disciplining themselves. Some have been self-instructed, but this self-instruction still requires the same skill and patience, and probably a great deal more willpower than the instruction by normal methods. So it is important to know that our conscious growth depends upon two more or less interlocked factors. One, our great desire to grow and to know, and the other, our willingness to work for what we desire. To get plenty of real effort, real libido behind this wish that we might be better. In other words, never for a moment permit the wish to be considered the act. The wish may start us, may give us some reason or purpose for doing something. But while it remains only in a wishful state, it is without vitality. It is impotent and useless. It must be transformed by discipline and dedication to an achieved state of usefulness. Realization has certain other values, but we can't pause with them too long because one of the principal parts of the lesson for this evening deals with the factor of illumination. Now, illumination is to the disciplined life of man that which is equivalent to the fruitfulness of the tree or the plant. In other words, all things have their growth and their budding and their flowering. But the true achievement is always fruitfulness. It is the fulfillment of the purpose for which the being exists. Our Eastern philosophers have always taught that what we broadly and rather weakly refer to as illumination is the natural destiny of all creatures possessed. In other words, it is the final victory of consciousness over these things, as we might suspect, however, from the very nature of the parallels used to express it, is not a victory times when these experiences seem to gather into larger patterns. But every time we open our eyes in the morning, it is a mystical experience about the day. And every time we close them at night, it is a mystical experience about the night. Everything, every faculty that responds and awakens, every experience that comes to us, is a continuous invitation to grow. And it is the acceptance, the simple, direct, factual, honest acceptance of these opportunities that gradually leads to the larger achievement. But just as the small child must first be taught its letters and then perhaps pass on to words, so each individual must be taught the small mysteries before he can comprehend the greater ones. At the moment in education, we are at a bit of an impasse. We are suddenly putting young people into college who cannot read the letters of the alphabet. This we begin to doubt as to whether it is progressive education or not. We begin to realize that nobody wants to learn the first steps anymore. We all want to start at the top and work down, and that's what most people do. We do not wish, when we study music, to play those abominable scales for 5 years. If we cannot play a complete composition in 2 weeks, we do not intend to be musicians. If we do play a complete composition in 2 weeks, it is doubtful if we will ever be musicians, because such a bad start is almost certain to condition the future. We lack patience, and we do the same thing in our religions. I know persons who have come very frankly and told me that they would very well like to attend our activities. In fact, if we had a membership, they'd join. Only on one condition, however, that they would be enlightened within 2 weeks. Well, they believed it. They had received very bad training, and I'm happy to say we didn't contribute any further errors to it. But the fact remains that we all have certain ambitions, and our spiritual ambitions are often dangerous, because they again destroy that peace within us, that realization, that quietude, which permits us to accept without question or doubt that all things come in their proper season and according to their proper time. So in the search for the enlargement of consciousness, we do seek illumination as a series of familiar experiences. Now, there are occasions, undoubtedly recorded, in which mystics have apparently broken through these veils very suddenly. There are cases, apparently, where in a single instant a life is transformed from a purely objective situation to a highly subjective one. But as we go through the lives of these mystics, we realize that this happened because, whether they knew it or not, they were under discipline, usually under the discipline of themselves. There is no doubt that the lines in Faust are correct, that luck is closely linked to merit, doth never to the fool occur, that he the wise man's stone. I swear it, the stone had no philosopher. And an example, perhaps two examples, come to mind at this point. One is Baron Emanuel Swedenborg. Swedenborg was suddenly, apparently, illumined. That he had some kind of very powerful interior experiences, we know. And we say to ourselves, well, he wasn't particularly dedicated to these things. More or less, apparently, an accident. Why can't the same accident happen to us? Well, as perhaps if you have studied Swedenborg's life more attentively, you are willing to live as he lived. Perhaps the accident might happen to you. But it would help a great deal if you had 40 years of higher mathematics, as he had. It would make all the difference in the world, because he had a magnificently trained mind. Now, the second thing we might mention, the second person, is Böhme, the German mystic and shoemaker. Here was a man who apparently received one of the most extraordinary revelations of all time, yet was not a man who was cultured, who was educated, or had achieved in these things which we commonly associate with life. And it is a little difficult to assume that merely pegging shoes was the full explanation. It wasn't. Again, if you want to live as he lived, it might then not be quite so mysterious if something of an extraordinary nature occurred to you. This man was born with one of the most extraordinary natures that I suppose was to be found in the world. From infancy, he was never known to have uttered an unkind word. He was never known to be angry at anyone. And from no particular purpose, as we can see it, but perhaps from the utter devotion and devoutness of his own heart, he lived throughout his life, both before and after this experience, in a state of the most profound, unselfish love for his fellow men. And his enemy during most of his entire life, self-appointed enemy, was a local theologian. And when Böhme went to church every Sunday, as he went to church, and sat quietly in his pew, he listened month after month and year after year, patiently, quietly, and with gentle dignity, while this minister heaped abuse upon him in every sermon. Yet never did he defend himself, never did he contradict, never did he say an unkind word to or about that clergyman. And on one occasion, when he went to beg this man to be less unkind and to try to understand that he, Böhme, was really a very devout and pious man, the clergyman threw his boots at him. Böhme quietly picked up the boots and put them back beside the clergyman's chair, said thank you, and walked out. If you want to live like that, it's quite possible a miraculous experience might also occur to you. So we cannot say, certainly, or evidently, that this mystical experience comes to those who do not deserve it. If it does, then there is no law in the universe. It has to be either consciously or unconsciously merited. But whereas some apparently have to discipline themselves to receive it in one way or another, others appear to be so naturally endowed with the gentlest of values, with the most unselfish and devout of attitudes, that this experience is perfectly normal and natural to them. But in each case, we will find that the life, to a measure and a large measure, to our own understanding, has produced a natural fruiting. It has come to that end which was suitable and proper to itself, never to something that is a contradiction. Illumination has been estimated in many ways. One question is, what are we to understand by the term cosmic consciousness? Is illumination to be regarded as an ultimate? Is there a condition in which we seem to stand as Dante stood in the presence of the celestial choirs and see the whole heavens unfold in their majesty? Is illumination to be understood thus as total conscious awareness, or in Buddhism, total absorption into being? Return to utter and infinite essence? Is it the final and unconditioned termination of all imperfect existence. This we do not know, because we are never able to determine the essential fact of consciousness apart from the instruments through which it operates. Therefore, we cannot be certain that by the term illumination, we actually mean ultimate or infinite. What in more probability we are meaning is the enlightenment of the state of consciousness as it exists in us and in the compound constitution which we inhabit. Therefore, illumination is in all probabilities victory over the present cycle of existence, victory over the uncertainties of a conditioned being. This victory over condition does not necessarily mean that there cannot be other conditions, nor does it mean that there cannot be other mysteries around which our illumination does not center, because these other mysteries are totally unknown to us. Therefore, about them, we can have no enlightened comprehension. But in any event, we may say that the mystical experience represents the most powerful factor in the justification of the individual's spiritual conviction. It is a transmutation of hopes and desires and yearnings and aspirations, their transmutation into established inner fact, from which there can no longer be any essential departure. Plotinus describes the illumination that came to him. He declared that on two or three occasions only during his life, he was privileged for a very brief instant to be lifted up into identity with reality. His nature was not such, his constitution was not such, that he could endure this state in a prolonged way. In a few instants, in a minute or two, he had exhausted his own power to react. The body simply could not carry the tremendous intensity of this experience, and he dropped back again into his normal consciousness. But he declared that these two or three brief experiences were such that from that time on, his mind, his outer life, his emotions, and his conduct could never depart from the truths which he had come to inwardly know. That he was working no longer from hopes and fears, but from certainties. And that once certainty took hold of the inner life, all uncertainty ceased. And then the reality could no longer be doubted or denied. And complete allegiance to this reality became natural and inevitable. There could no longer rise even a note of dissension. There was no other purpose for life as meaningful or as valuable. So I like to think, for students working along with this problem, that illumination is a continual, gradual unfoldment of spiritual appreciation, expressed continuously by better adjustments in action. For unless illumination leads to modification of conduct toward truth, it cannot be regarded as valid. Now, there is one point that perhaps will be of some interest here. In psychology, there is a reference made to what are called archetypal dreams. And it has been assumed by many psychologists that archetypal dreams have a particular and special authority, that they very seldom occur without an important consequence closely related to them. I would say that the difference between a true mystical experience and one which may arise out of self-hallucination or simply wishful thinking, the difference lies in this validity which accompanies the genuine experience. The individual who experiences a true internal mystical enlargenment does not experience something that is simply wonderful, simply beautiful, simply terrific. He doesn't have this experience of being a participant.